This is a HeadGum Podcast.
Achieving a gorgeous grin from home isn't a total mystery with BiteClear aligners. Just don't be surprised if all of your sleuthing friends start asking, "What's your secret?" Begin by ordering your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95. BiteClear aligners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces. Plus, they offer flexible financing, accept eligible insurance, and you can pay with your HSA FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
Hello, my dear friends. It is once again Michael Cruz Kane, back again with another episode of A Good Cry. I am going to try to zip through this little opening portion here because there's so much I want to say and there is such a good episode ahead of you. First, thank you so much for all the messages you've sent me on Twitter, on Instagram, etc. You can also email me at agoodcry@theradiopoint.com. Again, agoodcry@theradiopoint.com. And I will respond to your message, every single one. I am on my way to doing that. I am getting closer and closer. And if I haven't responded to you yet, I hope it will bring you some measure of comfort to know that I am absolutely racked with guilt at not having responded to every message so far. Okay, that's part one. Part two. I have a show opening at the Minetta Lane Theater in New York City, presented by Audible Theater. It starts April 28th. It ends on June 4th. You can get tickets at sorryforyourlossshow.com. And this has been a crazy process. People at Audible have been absolutely amazing. My family has been so supportive, et cetera, et cetera. But there is an element of it that I had not prepared myself for psychologically, I guess, which is the pressure of knowing that every word I say about my son, about my family, about my wife, about me, those will live forever, and they're scripted. You know, like, it's different from doing this podcast where almost everything I say is from a free-flowing conversation. This is stuff that I wrote down. These are words that I chose. Are they the right words? I mean, I guess you never know that as a writer, right? But I hope so much that I choose words that honor my family in the right way, and that if my son could see that show from wherever he is, and he may be nowhere, that he would go, "Oh, that was cool. I'm glad you did that." That's part two. Part three is this episode of A Good Cry featuring the fantastic, brilliant, etc., Orna Guralnick, who is the host of Couples Therapy on Showtime. Now, I know this intro has already been very long, so I'm going to zip through my recommendation of Couples Therapy on Showtime, which is such a good show. It gives you such insight into the real work that has to be done between couples and with Orna when they're working on their relationships. It's not just drama. It's like the work. Obviously, you're not seeing all the work because it's, you know, a finite number of episodes. But I think they're about to release season 4, and every season has been eye-opening to me. We get into so much in this episode. Orna is so thoughtful and so learned and experienced on so many subjects. I would say the thing that stuck with me the most was the idea of motion, that one of the ways to cope and to live with grief is to try and keep yourself in some kind of movement. That doesn't necessarily mean physical, although I think it can mean that, but it's also like just not staying stuck in the moment that you are in, even though it might feel impossible to get yourself unstuck. Just like one foot in front of the other. Just get in the shower. I could keep talking about it, but I think it's much better for you to hear it from her. Orna Guralnick, A Good Cry. I hope it helps. Orna, thanks for being here. The way that we start the podcast off is by asking our guest to describe their relationship with grief. Could you talk about your relationship to grief?
I might need a reframing of the question.
Yeah, sure. So typically, I interview people who have some personal experience that they want to talk about with grief. In your case, I think that's probably going to be different.
Got it. I get the question. Okay. So my relationship to grief. Let's start with the fact that I spent formative years of my life in Israel. And whoever's lived in Israel long enough has a very deep and ongoing familiarity with grief, because it is a country that is often at war. So people come and go, people die. We are a country that is in a very complicated relationship with the Palestinians. So we're also responsible for lots of death. And then a lot of people that found their way to Israel come from histories of persecution, you know, Holocaust and other horrid situations. So there's also a lot of intergenerational transmission of grief and trauma. So that all culminates in a style of living whereby it's very easy for people, for example, to get killed driving because people are kind of reckless. There's some way that grief infiltrates everything that people do, and there is some feeling that life is very precarious. So there's also endless accidents. So when you live in Israel, I mean, grief is just like, you know, it's like daily living.
Like the air you breathe, kind of.
It's like the air you breathe. It's like completely normal. I have a cultural deep familiarity with grief and have been, in my entire life really, have been kind of exposed to death and people struggling with it ongoingly. Personally, I've lost plenty of people. We can talk about that maybe later. But most importantly, I'm a clinical psychologist and a psychoanalyst, so over the years, obviously, one of the things that people work on in treatment is grief, whether it's happening while they're in treatment or they're carrying grief that is unresolved or other people's grief that they need to deal with. So grief is part of everyone's life, but consciously it's part of my life.
You talked a lot about your upbringing. Do you find there to be a vast difference in the way that an American and an Israeli might process tragedies that are national or personal?
Yeah, definitely. To think about it in a way, in a simplistic way, I think when you grow up in a place like Israel, since grief is such a day in, day out thing, people are used to it. It's not such a shock, and therefore society at large has developed ways to guide people through how to deal with grief, how to deal with each other when they're grieving, and how to think about it, for good and for bad, in the sense that every time you organize an experience, it both helps people go through it, but it also gets rid of all the nuances and the idiosyncrasies, and there's like a certain kind of program that people are put through that helps, but is also, it obfuscates some of the stuff that people are really feeling. And in the States, I find people oddly confused and not knowing what to do with grief, even though we all die and we all know people that die. But it's like a shock and some way that people don't exactly know how to deal with it. Like people somehow made a contract to dissociate from the whole idea of death.
I'm laughing because that's just so, that strikes me as so true. I don't know anything about Israel, but I know that here there's a lot of sort of performance of perfection and like happiness and youth all the time. And so the sudden exposure of sadness is like a betrayal of this agreement that we've all made with each other to be happy. It's like, you know, to be living in a sitcom all the time.
Yeah, it's a very good way of putting it. I relate to that. Yes.
One of the words you used when you were talking about grief in terms of your work is resolved. What does that word mean in the context of your work?
Did I use that word? Did I use it seriously?
I think you did. I mean, I may have misheard. I may
I'm
have misheard
glad you.
You
picked up on it, because if I did, let's pause on that word. Because I think part of that, you know, what you described as the culture of youth and happiness, there's also this idea that grief is a thing that you go through in stages and then you resolve it. Like there's like an end point beyond which you're already now, that's a problem. You're not doing it right.
Right. We've had enough.
Yeah. Like, you know, and if you asked managed care companies, that would probably be 12 weeks. So in a certain way, I don't really buy the idea of like resolution of grief. I think grief is a very big thing. It's like a one little word, but it's like grief is so many things. It's so many things. I mean, we can spend hours in books and whatever talking about what is grief. But to try to stay a little more simple about it, I think people have very different ways to experience loss and grief. And each person goes through their own process and whatever they need to go through. And they get to a point where they might be able to resume living and the capacity for joy or whatever else their normal life looks like. But I don't know when grief is really over. And for some people it is over, and for some people it isn't. It's just part of sort of a thread that accompanies them through life. I do know that there is a lot of pressure on people to resolve grief, as if it's like a big burden on other people. I'm going to say all of that, and then I think it would be good to mention, I don't know if through your work on grief, if people talk to you about this like incredible essay of Freud, Mourning and Melancholia.
No.
Highly recommend it. It's an incredible essay. It's not long, and you know, Freud to some degree, you know, he's given the world a lot, but a lot of what he's written doesn't feel relevant anymore. But this essay is still kind of an incredible essay. And he does make a distinction there between mourning, like the process of like the slow process of coming to terms with losing someone, and then melancholia, which is this situation where a person can get, quote, stuck and kind of refuse to move beyond, that there's something about whatever they're going through that things are not moving, not changing. There's a way in which there's a holding on to who you've lost that doesn't allow you to really develop, to continue developing. And in that sense, not resolved. We can get into that some more, but do you have any thoughts on this?
Well, I'm fascinated by it. Most of the people I talk to are people like me who have experienced this but don't have the arsenal of vocabulary and experience that you have on a professional level. I've just re-entered therapy. I hadn't been in therapy for a while, and now I'm back in it. And there's so much of it that is like fascinating to me. And when you talk about melancholia and feeling stuck, the word that springs to mind that I know is the wrong word, but are there tricks, so to speak? I mean, forgive the clumsiness of that, that either that you would use to help someone get through that, or that people can try to use on their own? Or is that just like, you know, such a superficial question that it's preposterous?
No, it's not a superficial question. It's not, we have to distinguish between analytic work, which is what I do, psychoanalytic work, let's say spiritual existential work, which sometimes we do some of. And then there are other ways that people work. I mean, there are many, many ways that people work through whatever they're going through, whatever trauma, grief, whatever they're going through, which is not only analytic. So in the world of tricks, I mean, obviously, you know, get out of bed, take a shower, put fresh clothes on, and get out into the world is like the basic trick of living. Move.
Yeah,
that's the trick we all have to do every day, you know?
Yeah.
But when you work on grief analytically, you open up the space to delve into what's harder than and what gets in the way despite the tricks, or what's still there even when you're doing the tricks. And if you can't do the tricks, how to get you to that point that you can get out of bed.
And that, from watching your work on the show, which I assume to a very great degree mirrors your work in like in your general practice, one of the things that I'm blown away by is the way in which you're so measured about how much you lead people in a direction and how much you let them lead themselves.
Mm-hmm.
I'm going to paraphrase you terribly, but at one point, I think you said this, we were having a discussion with your peers and talking about, oh no, you know what? It was an interview that I heard you give where you talked about not wanting to insert yourself too much into the process and sort of letting, is patience the right word? Letting the patients sort of guide themselves and like sort of explore it and find it for themselves. And I can tell you, as someone who's re-entered therapy and, you know, been in therapy before, there are definitely times when I'm sitting with the therapist being like, don't you just know how to fix this? And like, just, could you just say the thing so I can leave and be better now? But of course, I understand that's not right. But when I guess when I leap to the idea of tricks or sort of perceiving a therapist as someone who has a potion, I think there is that hope, and there must be among people who come to see you, that you've seen this before. You've had a million patients. You know what the problem is. Just tell me what it is and I can leave.
Yeah. First of all, sometimes I want to have that potion too to offer.
Right.
And sometimes I do have a potion. There are moments where I have a potion, where I know what the person needs to hear or what would be a good idea for them to do. And I'll offer a potion and sometimes it works. But that's kind of the rare moment. That's not the real day-to-day work of therapy. The day-to-day work, it's sort of similar to what we were saying earlier about grief and the relationship between the individual, the subject, and whoever's around them. I mean, there's people always, in a way, are pressured to produce something that will fit, right? Will make everyone comfortable. And it's very rare for them to have a space in which they're really trying to figure out what's actually going on for them. And it's very precious. And patients that want that potion, sometimes you give them the potion and you're robbing them of exploration. They really, you know, especially when we're talking about grief, on one hand, people are desperate to feel better, but they also really need someone to be able to hang in there with them while they're suffering and not urge them to go anywhere else but where they're at. And in my mind, that is the most important part of grief, is to be able to go through all the million components of saying goodbye to someone who left the world and left you with all that you have inside. And if you can have a little bit of company going through that very lonely and difficult process, that's everything.
And that makes a lot of sense to me. I think in terms of what we were talking about before with resolution, it's more for me like been a journey to make the pain tolerable, because I know that it will continue to exist. And even now, it is tolerable. I mean, even when I'm occasionally overwhelmed by a memory or whatever, I now find those moments of sadness almost sweet. It's like nice to remember and be kind of like laid low by it for a minute.
Yeah. You find a way to be with yourself in a way that is rich and full of meaning.
When you are dealing with patients who are experiencing or trying to recover from grief, how much do you bring of yourself as a person? Be like, you know, there's your training, obviously, which is extensive. And there's also Orna, the human being. Mm-hmm. How much of yourself do you bring to those people and to their care?
In a certain way, I bring all of myself, in the sense that I bring my, I don't know, whatever we want to call it, my heart, my emotional resonance, and whatever I'm capable of. Because sometimes things can be too much for me, or I'm not resonating, but I bring myself fully, for good and for bad. This doesn't mean that I talk about my personal experiences. It just means that I'm there, and people can feel how much I'm there with them or not. I'm not the kind of analyst or therapist that brings myself in the form of stories about myself. I find that usually is not helpful. But I'm there emotionally and with my mind and with the experience that I've accrued. Does that make sense?
Of course, yeah, it makes a lot of sense. I think what I'm wondering in addition to that is, let's say that, you said it's not stories, but let's say that something that a patient is going through, you empathize with it on a level that is profound because of your personal experience. Is that something that you're like, let me just wall that off? That's something I'll deal with that on my own time. Or do you ever bring that, I guess, I'm not sure that there is a medium, but without telling fully, you know, some story from your 20s or whatever, do you ever bring that into the meetings?
I don't think I never do it, but that would not be my inclination. I think people can feel it if I understand them, really understand them or not. There probably are rare occasions that I would feel compelled and like it would be a good idea to actually say something specific, like I've actually been through this or someone close to me has been through this, but that would be rare.
Makes sense.
Yeah. And probably a mistake.
Yeah, I guess that's what I'm asking. Like that would be something that you would think of as like, I probably shouldn't have done that. Like in general, you would frown on bringing that level of sharing on that level with a patient.
I don't know.
Okay, fair enough. Because I think for me, whenever I'm in therapy, I've always perceived my therapist as like this enigma, which I'm sure is generally good.
Yeah.
But I am always curious. Like, you know, when I say X, Y, Z about my life, I'm like, what is that? Like, what's that doing for you?
Right. But on some level, you can probably feel.
Yes, I think that's true. Particularly when she articulates, I mean, what will happen is that she will articulate something in a way that I hadn't thought of it, but that once it's been said is so obvious and clear that it like, kind of like shakes away a bunch of debris that was around this core idea. And I'm like, oh shit. Yeah, of course this.
Yeah. And then you know, she's right there.
Yes. That makes a lot of sense.
Okay. And in a way that it takes one to know one.
Right. Yeah. I guess that in a way that she wouldn't be able to say that if she had no understanding of what that is.
Yeah.
A way in which we don't often approach grief on this podcast is as it pertains to relationships, to mm-hmm. love. And a lot of your show deals with people who are working through, all of your show deals with people who are working through romantic difficulties or, you know, intimacy difficulties. Can you talk about how the breakup or dissolution of a relationship is also a kind of grief, if it is?
Sure. Breakups, again, there could be many animals. Breakups could be all sorts of things for people. But, you know, one crude way to think of it in terms of the question of grief is that a breakup often includes the universe that is grief, the grief of losing someone that you love, that you care about, that meant something to you internally and that you meant something to them. And then it includes lots of other things that are not about grief, that are, for some people, are about fears of what now, settling all sorts of old accounts, which happens in regular grief too, ego issues, injuries, narcissistic injuries, who left who, why, was I not good enough? So there's lots of other things that get kind of mixed up into like simply the loss of someone you love. But, you know, when people manage to move aside, if you wish, the debris of all these other like ego things, then breakup usually entail a lot of grief that is ongoing. When you really get connected to someone, when you really love someone and they come to live inside you as a loved person, then saying goodbye for whatever reasons means grief. It's loss.
Well, I guess a question that springs to mind is, do the techniques or what have you that someone might employ to try and help them tolerate grief that's related to death, do those still generally apply in someone who has lost someone who still exists?
It's a good question. I think there's something about death that is very different from breakup, something really big and really different, both the irreversibility of it, in the sense that you can't continue a dialogue with someone who's dead unless it's just internally, but that kind of complete finality and no more, and the fact that the person stops existing, at least in this form, I mean, that's a whole other thing than breakup.
Sure, sure, sure.
But some things are more similar, like the missing and the having to deal with not having what you had, sort of your own dealing with the absence could be similar. And in that sense, I'm thinking in my mind, because I have all sorts of cases that come into my mind, it's different. It's different and it's similar. It's different in the sense that in breakups, there's often so much like questions about what happened, the self, who did what to who, responsibility, which can happen in certain situations of death as well. I mean, people can get completely wrapped up in that, but that is usually not the essence. The essence is just the finality. But in terms of like moving through things, I guess the if we had to talk about common denominator, I mean, one is creating space for feelings to come and go and come and go, kind of making space internally for this amazing thing that our emotional system has, which is that nothing ever remains the same. It's always changing. So you might get kind of overwhelmed by a wave of grief, but you know, you live through it and then there's another wave that comes and there are other feelings that are there. And it's this amazing thing that as frightening as it is, it never remains solid. It's not like a piece, a block of ice that doesn't move. It just, there's always movement in there. And from the little bit I understand about your show and what you've done here, I mean, the fact that I know that you're committed to kind of allowing some humor in as well, there are other feelings that are there to kind of carry you through. It's never only one thing. Like the emotional system is a vast and interesting system that has a lot to offer if you just give space.
I like to think that's true. As a comedian myself, it's hard not to see even like the most fucked up stuff through a prism of, I mean, that is a little bit funny though, right? Like it's hard to disassociate right. That part of my brain. Like, do you find that humor plays a role in the, like in the sessions that you have that are the most fraught, how often do those same sessions also have people take a break and laugh at something that might seem really out of bounds?
First of all, I have to tell you that Israelis are like amazing at laughing at like in like the most dramatically horrible moment. I mean, there's no way that an Israeli will not say something absurdly funny. It's just part of Israeli culture. So, but in terms of in therapy sessions, I would never introduce a joke.
I think that makes sense to me.
Yeah. And but if a patient can, that's wonderful. That's wonderful. I mean, you're always looking for like movement and for more, kind of an expansion in the capacity to feel and think and experience things. So in the depth of grief, I mean, there's always something absurd about our lives, always. It's always there. I mean, you just have to like step into that prism and it's waiting. So if a patient can be in the depth of grief and also, hey, by the way, step outside of that and look at it through the prism of absurdity or humor or fun, that's wonderful. I mean, it's our best human self.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's true.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's true because you're probably referring to the fact that it can also be a defense, right? That,
yes.
That humor can also shield you from your feelings, but it doesn't have to be.
Yeah, there's always, as a comedian, especially someone who does comedy or who works on comedy that can be political, this is a bit of a digression, but a concern that I always have is that line between, am I doing something that is generally good for you by making you laugh? I know the laughing makes you feel good. I know you like that.
Right.
But then it's also like, am I Am I helping you sort of numb this part of you that maybe does need to feel, maybe you need to feel the purity of the pain for a second?
Interesting.
And I do wonder as a comedian if it's like, should I be helping you with this, or should I just let you feel how you feel about it? And then, you know, maybe there's a time for jokes that is not now. I wonder how important, not, I don't want to force you into being my therapist.
but it makes me think that you should talk to Jon Stewart about that. Like, why did he stop doing comedy in that sense?
Yeah, I think there has to be an element, especially people of great stature, where they, mm-hmm. where you have a wondering of, you know, I know I'm funny. There's no doubt about it. Now, what am I going to do with that? What social benefit, or, you know, maybe that's too grandiose, but what goodness can I do?
No, it's not grandiose. It's so important. My God.
Yeah.
I don't have an answer to that, but I really like the question.
Okay. Well, I was sort of hoping for an answer, but you can't get everything.
The comfort of your favorite seat is now your comfy car selling command center, thanks to Carvana.
It doesn't get any better than this.
Your favorite seat's the best spot in the house. Make it even better by entering your license plate or VIN and getting a real offer in minutes.
There really is no place like home.
And speaking of home, Carvana will pick up your car from yours after you finalize your offer. Visit Carvana.com or download the app and sell your car from your comfy place.
Delve into the shadows of the mind with Sleeping Dogs, a gripping murder mystery starring Academy Award winner Russell Crowe, now available on digital. Crowe portrays an ex-homicide detective unraveling a brutal murder he can't recall. Uncovering secrets from his past, he learns a chilling truth. It's best to let sleeping dogs lie. Visit sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery to watch Sleeping Dogs, now on digital. That's sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery.
So one of the things you talked about was, I think you brought up a couple of times, is movement. The idea of like change, or maybe change is not exactly right, but movement.
Mm-hmm.
Can you talk more about that as a concept? When you said at the very beginning, I asked you about tricks, you were like, well, get up, go take a shower, move. That's obviously a very physical manifestation of that.
Yeah.
But there are also emotional movement. Can you just talk more about that concept?
Sure. I think generally as living beings, a state of health and harmony means movement, means the thing that we're, you know, thoughts are flowing, feelings are flowing, we're developing, we're learning, we're interacting with the world, we're part of something that is always changing. And in that sense, you could say that pathology is when things freeze and get stuck. And there's kind of a, either out of fear or you're kind of really shut down by grief or whatever is happening, and then movement stops and your thoughts get frozen and your feelings get frozen. You can't generate new thoughts. You can't generate new experiences. You're frozen. You're stuck. That's a sign of pathology. So what we're always looking for is a sense that things are moving, that your thoughts are moving, that feelings come, feelings go, things are changing. You're with the world moving along. And in that sense, when you know that that's happening, even when something is very painful, you know it's not like that forever. You know you're experiencing it now and you don't know where it's taking you. And you want to remain open and curious to where it's going to take you.
That makes a lot of sense. Another thing you brought up and brought up again there is the idea of changing. Like, you know, we're all constantly changing. And as a result, do you think of therapy as something that sort of is indefinite? Like when you see someone, is your work always couples or are you?
No.
Okay.
No,
so
I have probably a third of my practice is couples and the rest is individual.
Gotcha. So when you see someone, is your expectation in general that, you know, I'm meeting so-and-so on this day, I expect that our relationship professionally will continue for a very long time? Or are you ever like, so I feel like we could kind of clear this up and, you know, whatever the issue is here, we can clear it up in, you know, 6 months, we should be done.
No, I don't have a fixed idea. With couples, the work is usually shorter. I mean, I have the rare couples that see it as more like, you know, maintenance, but couples, it's usually shorter term. But with individuals, it really varies why people are coming. I mean, some people stay in analysis for a very long time, and some people less. I mean, I don't do short-term therapy usually unless I'm asked to come in for a consultation, which, you know, if it happens to be something that I think I would be particularly good at, I might do it, but usually I don't do short-term consultations. So I do psychoanalysis, so it's relatively longer term, but it doesn't have to be indefinitely. And similar to what we were saying about like change and movement, the person exhausted me, meaning they've gotten everything they can get out of me and I'm basically just saying the same thing. The treatment is sort of done because they know what I'm going to say. If they know exactly what I'm going to say at every moment in time, they don't need me.
And is that something that, in that case, would they initiate or would you ever be like, I think we kind of did it here?
I might suggest it. I don't always know who I am to my patient. Sometimes they might surprise me and say, well, that's true, but I need to be coming here for this and this reason. I won't kick a patient out.
Okay.
But I'll check to see if they feel like I'm still useful to them, that they're not stuck by way of stuck with me.
Right. That they don't have to get another therapist to talk about their relationship
exactly.
with the therapist.
Exactly. That is not unheard of.
Another thing that people ask about and that you would be, I think, a good person to ask about is the stages of grief that have sort of been popularized. I think it's Elizabeth Kubler-Ross.
Kubler-Ross.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Are those stages something that have meaning to you in your work? Do people care about that at all?
Yes, they care. When people are at sea and they don't understand what's happening to them, when they're overwhelmed by really, really difficult feelings, it's helpful for them to know, first of all, that they still belong to the human race, that what they're experiencing hasn't like thrown them off of humanity and nobody else has ever been through this and they're just unintelligible to the rest of the world. So to know that, yes, there are stages. You're going through something that other people have been through. It's going to take this form and then that form and then that form. It can be hugely helpful to people just to feel like they're held by humanity, by something that other people have been through. And to be able to name things that they're feeling is very helpful. Now, I don't think people always follow exactly Kubler-Ross's sequence and in that exact sequence, and people move back and forth between things. But, you know, people negotiate with reality. They go through anger. She's identified very common themes that people go through when they're grieving. And in that sense, I think the fact that she's written so much about it and so much has been written about that theory is very helpful to people. Again, you know, when you give people these kind of guidelines, it organizes them, but it also takes away from their individuality because each person actually then goes through their own thing and no person is similar to the other and no death is exactly like the other. And the factors that will suddenly matter to you, you never know in advance what's going to show up for you. Why does that thing stick in your head? So there's a lot of idiosyncrasy as well.
Right. Yeah, I guess that makes a lot of sense. And I know you've already said it twice, but I'm just reiterating it for myself because it's very profound to me. But the idea that that kind of framework can be very empowering and make you feel like you are not alone, but it can also be isolating because you don't cohere exactly to the framework.
Exactly.
And I think that has been my experience with grief in general, not specifically vis-a-vis that framework, but the sense of not cohering with like the wider world that like, you know, my son died and I walk outside and people are just at McDonald's ordering food. It's like, I don't understand how we can be in the same reality.
How we're in the same. Yeah, I know. I mean, grief in that sense is like incredibly isolating. Yeah.
And I think to go back to the idea culturally of how you describe Israel, where the idea of grief is commonplace. It's part of the air.
Yeah.
how much I wish it were that way here. I mean, obviously, the price that you pay, there's a heavy cost. Like the reason that exists is a heavy price was paid, which obviously I don't want. So if there's a way to get the benefit without any of the cost, that would be perfect.
Well, I think that's what you're trying to do, no, with your show.
Yes, that's the goal. If it only helps one person, and if that person's me, that's fine.
So I think it's super important to take that on. It always makes me cringe for a second when people say when someone dies or something like that, and people say, I hope you're okay.
Yeah.
Why do you hope they're okay? They're not okay.
It would be crazy if they were okay.
Yeah, why do you hope they're okay?
There's just no concept of it. So it's so hard for the people adjacent to you to reckon with it at all. And I think that I've talked about on this podcast before, and other people have shared their own stories, is when you start to tell people about how you're feeling or what happened to you that they didn't know about, it's often the case that they become 10 times more upset about it than you happen to be at this moment. And now you have to shift into a new mode of, hey, are you, you know, like something terrible has happened to me. Are you okay?
Right. Right. Either that, or there's this kind of distance that gets created where people just don't want anything to do with feelings.
Exactly.
And they start peddling in all sorts of ways. Yeah. And then if you say something funny, then it becomes super awkward.
Right, because they're pretending it hasn't even happened. I want to talk about your show more, if that's okay, because I've just finished watching season 3 and am obsessed with it. And you are brilliant in life, but also on the show.
Thank you.
And I wanted to ask about an aspect of it that's interesting to me because I'm in entertainment, which I guess crudely is the category that a show like this sort of falls into, is how hard is it to maintain the sanctity of your work when, at least on some level, you and the people that you're seeing are aware that millions of people, or I don't know how many people, but I'm assuming millions of people are going to see them reveal whatever it is about themselves and see and watch you and, you know, critique your style or whatever.
It's a very good question, and it's not obvious. The directors and producers and really the people that came up with this, like Josh Kriegman and Elise Steinberg and Eli Dupre, they've created this, the whole way that we do the filming of the show, they've created this kind of bubble, both in the way the studio actually is and in how we're interacting around the show, that is in the center of it is the sanctity of the treatment. So everyone is geared towards the fact that this is, first of all and foremost, a treatment in which we are all committed to the couples getting the help they need. And everything else is kind of kept on the sides and is dealt with later. They're basically there to kind of collect footage, make sure everyone is okay, and be super respectful. And then it gets thrown into like the editing world, and it's sort of not our problem. So there's a very good split between the editing side and what we're doing there. And when we're in the studio, it's almost like going to a clinic and working at a clinic where everyone is devoted to the well-being of the patients. We don't call them patients, they're participants. So everyone's like super respectful and concerned about the people. And it's like, I don't know, it's a very special universe. And then we're also unbelievably lucky because the people at Showtime that we're working with, the network that is like hosting and sponsoring the show, they're very hands-off. I mean, they just want to make sure it's like quality, but they do not intervene. They don't ask for things. They don't, I mean, there's no, in a way, there's no ask for entertainment, sensation. There's no ask for anything other than do what you're good at.
That's wonderful.
I know, it's amazing.
I bet that also remains true because they are so blown away. Like if season one, for example, had been a disaster, you may end up with more of some guy in a suit being like, what if you asked him more about sex or whatever?
Right.
Does it ever come up in the treatment that someone there will say, and I'm also feeling very aware of, like, does that happen?
Of course, yeah. Anything is, I mean, it's therapy, you know, people talk about what's going on. So we talk a lot about their anxiety about being there. You know, people can say something and then suddenly get worried about like, oh my God, what if this actually does air and my father sees it? It's part of what we talk about. I mean, the truth of the matter is that, and you probably know this from the show, once you start working, the whole idea that it's going to be late or maybe TV, that kind of leaves the room. You're just in the conversation like we are right now.
It just kind of like takes on a momentum of its own.
It's sort of, it's life. It's where life really is. And then everything else is like later. I'll worry about it later.
In every season, all of the couples go through some transformations at, you know, at varying levels of profundity, but all of them pretty significant. When a couple decides that they are going to, you know, implement the things you've been talking about and it leads to, you know, some kind of a renaissance in their, you know, their sex life or whatever, that's sort of one, as a viewer, that's like one type of outcome. And another outcome is at the end of this, the couple goes, you know what? I think that we shouldn't be together anymore. I think this is the end of our relationship. As a therapist, are you hoping that they're going to stay together, or is that not really part of it? Like, I guess for me as a viewer, I'm always like, come on, Ping, figure it out. Like, you and Will can do it. So when it doesn't work out, I'm like, ah, shit. But I also know as an adult that some people aren't supposed to be together. Like, so, you know, it's not going to work for everybody. Do
Am
you
I
have
neutral?
An outcome in mind? What's that?
You're asking if I'm neutral.
Yeah, I'm asking if you're neutral.
Yeah, it's a really good question. I think I'm biased towards staying together. I will do everything I can to help a couple stay together. I mean, unless there's some reason where I think like absolutely not, which is rare. I mean, if there's like abuse, if it's like really bad, toxic, but otherwise I'm leaning towards staying together. But I also know that for some people, breaking up and breaking up well could be like really, really good. Like to have a good breakup, a breakup in which you understand why you're separating and it doesn't collapse into some kind of blame game or some kind of, you know, self-deception. But when it's really people dealing with the reality of what's not working and deciding with mutual respect to break up, it can be a real growth experience and a profound thing.
I'm smirking only because, I mean, I haven't broken up with anyone in a very long time, but whenever I did, whew, it was bad.
It was bad,
I never quite mastered the good breakup.
It's an important one.
Yeah, I bet.
Really?
I bet.
Yeah.
Okay, my last question. That's a little bit of a turn from where we were, but I would it'd be very interested to get your thoughts on this. A question I ask at the end of the podcast, everyone, is do you think of the people that you have lost in your life as being somewhere now?
I think about it a lot. A lot. I think of it, I mean, this is my own sort of, and it changes a lot, but I think of it as I think there's a way of what we call being, which is not what we imagine being. I think of it as there's probably some way that something continues that is in a form that we cannot at all imagine because we are tied to our bodies and this brain of ours. So I think something always continues, but it's not something that I can imagine.
That makes as much sense as it can.
Right.
This was A Good Cry with Orna Guralnick. Thanks for listening. I hope it helps. A Good Cry is brought to you by RadioPoint and HeadGum with executive producers Alex Bach. I'm talking Sabrina Fonfetter and Daniel Powell. Of course, Richard Corson and don't you forget Houston Snyder. It is also produced by V. Abigail Lowenthal and mixed and edited by the one and only Ian Sorrentino.
That was a HeadGum Podcast.